From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Florida led the country in the number of new HIV cases in January. The governor and state surgeon general were criticized for not taking the increase seriously. Shortly after, the Tampa Bay Times reported the Florida Department of Health adjusted those 2014 numbers, moving the state out of the lead spot. We'll explore this controversy in how the DOH adjusts HIV numbers. Plus, public health experts worry that when it comes to the millennial generation, many young people do not take HIV prevention as seriously as they should. The issue could stem from younger people today not having experienced the onset of the AIDS era in the 1980s or understanding its impact, particularly on the LGBT community. That's ahead on Gulf Coast Live. First, this news.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 2014, an estimated 9,731 youth aged 13 to 24 were diagnosed with HIV in the U.S. That accounts for about 22% of all new HIV diagnoses. In 2012, an estimated 44% of HIV-positive youth aged 18 to 24 years old didn't know they had it. Public health experts worry about the millennial generation's attitudes toward HIV prevention because today's youth didn't live through the AIDS crisis of the 1980s. The nonprofit Visuality Incorporated and Florida Gulf Coast University's Gay Straight Alliance are holding a panel discussion April 20th to educate and inform participants about the history of the AIDS epidemic and its impact on the LGBT community. For the remainder of the hour, we'll delve into the struggle with stories of those who lived it, and we'll explore public health efforts to convince young people to take AIDS prevention seriously. Joining me now is Arlene Goldberg. She's co-founder and board member of Visuality, Inc., which provides a safe haven environment for Southwest Florida's LGBTIQ youth and advocates on their behalf. Arlene and her late wife, Carol Goldwasser, were among the eight couples who were plaintiffs in the lawsuit that led to Florida officially recognizing same-sex marriages. She'll be moderating next week's panel discussion on the AIDS era. And Arlene, welcome back.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
We're also joined in studio by Dr. Billy Huff, communication professor here at Florida Gulf Coast University, a Visuality board member and faculty advisor for Florida Gulf Coast University's Gay Straight Alliance. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Dr. John Brady is also a communication professor here at FGCU. He and Dr. Huff will both be panelists at next Wednesday's Visuality Voices panel discussion. Welcome, Dr. Brady.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
And we're also speaking with David Fairman Jackson. He's an outreach and prevention specialist with the McGregor Clinic in Fort Myers. Great to have you back on the program as well.
Thanks for having us back.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation, connect with our guests, and call. Phone lines are open at 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media or tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Arlene, before we delve into next week's panel discussion topic, tell me just a little bit about the work and mission of Visuality.
Well, Visuality is the only LGBT youth center here in Southwest Florida. And we serve children, actually youth, ages 13 through 17 and then 18 through 24. And we do social events and we do things like this Visuality Voices, trying to get out into the community and educate the public about what's going on with our youth and our community.
And, you know, when you were growing up and coming of age, I can't imagine anything like Visuality had even existed. But what do you think it would have meant to you to have had, you know, a safe place like that?
It would have been wonderful. Kids had nowhere to go. Everybody was in the closet. They were hiding, lying to their parents, and just nowhere to go. And now having a safe place here in Southwest Florida, a very conservative community, is a good start for us.
And Dr. Huff, tell us a little bit about this series of public panel discussions. We were just speaking in the hall a moment ago, and you'd had a first installment, and now the second one seems to follow sort of a chronological pattern.
Yes, absolutely. So we decided with Visuality that we also wanted to do advocacy and education. And as I work with the Gay Straight Alliance, and I also teach courses on sexuality and gender at FGCU, I realize that the students aren't very informed about the history. The students, before they get to college, don't receive any gay positive type of education in the school system. So they are really very ignorant about a lot of these things that actually inform their lives in ways they don't even realize. And so we started out with how we got here, which started with the Stonewall Rebellion that kind of sparked the gay liberation movement. And this time we're focusing on AIDS, the AIDS era in the 1980s and 1990s. And I can say for sure that the students don't really know that what people went through during that period, and the legacy that they have. And a lot of them are no longer with us. So.
Well, I wanted to kind of set the stage for this discussion a bit with a little piece of audio. And this is actually from NBC News' first ever report on the AIDS crisis on June 16th of 1982. In this excerpt, we'll hear reporter Robert Bazell reporting on what then they thought was a rare form of cancer that seemed to only be affecting homosexual men. Let's hear that now.
Scientists at the National Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta today released the results of a study which shows that the lifestyle of some male homosexuals has triggered an epidemic of a rare form of cancer. Robert Bazell now in Atlanta.
Bobby Campbell of San Francisco and Billy Walker of New York both suffer from a mysterious newly discovered disease which affects mostly homosexual men but has also been found in heterosexual men and women. The condition severely weakens the body's ability to fight disease. Many victims get a rare form of cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma. Others get an infection known as pneumocystis pneumonia. Researchers know of 413 people who have contracted the condition in the past year. One third have died and none have been cured.
Death didn't scare me. It was living with this for a long time. That's more frightening than death.
Investigators have examined the habits of homosexuals for clues.
I was in the fast lane at one time in terms of the way that I lived my life, and now I'm not.
The best guess is that some infectious agent is causing it.
Today, researchers here at the National Centers for Disease Control said they had found several cases where people who had been sex partners both had the condition. The scientists say this probably means they are dealing with some new, deadly, sexually transmitted disease.
The investigators see this as a serious public health problem.
From an epidemic point of view, there have been more deaths from Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis pneumonia than have occurred with all the cases of toxic shock syndrome and the Philadelphia outbreak of Legionnaires' disease combined.
Researchers are now studying blood and other samples from the victims, trying to learn what is causing the disease. So far, they have had no luck. Robert Bazell, NBC News, Atlanta.
And I really just thought that clip did a lot to explain how little we knew back then. And I think we all know that lack of knowledge sort of creates fear. And this is something that was occurring at a time when public sentiment towards homosexuals was very different than it was today. I was wondering if, you know, each of us could maybe go around the room and maybe talk about sort of some of the salient memories in your minds from living through that time. And Arlene, can you start?
Well, yeah, I lived in New York at that time, and unfortunately, I was in the closet, so I wasn't terribly involved in it, and it did not affect the lesbian community. It did affect the gay community, but certainly it was big news, and having something that had no cure, it was really scary. It was very scary for everybody. Everybody was living on the edge. They were afraid.
Mm-hmm. And John, you were in New York at that time as well, correct?
No, I was actually in Chicago at the time, and you know, everybody was really fearful about what it was and how it would be, like, transmitted. I mean, there were rumors that mosquito bites would do it. I was a swimmer at the time, and just being in the pool caused great amounts of fear. I would talk to friends of mine, and there was this dark cloud constantly over you that any sort of sexual activity, because you did not know what was, you know, how you got this, where it was coming from, who it could be, there was always that, you know, just absolute fear. And I remember we used to take like our latest test results when we went out, because if you were going to have sex, you had to almost prove your status at that time. So it was just frightening, and it was everywhere, and anytime you just made love was like fearful.
Mm. Billy Huff?
Yes. So I was a little young during that period. My uncle, however, contracted the HIV virus in a bathhouse in Atlanta, and that was before you know, they closed them all down. And my family always said he contracted the disease because he was mugged and got it from someone else. The shame that went along with it, the stigma that went along with it was what stuck out to me during that period.
And David, I'm not sure you're even old enough to remember.
Well, I was not able to experience it directly, being from New Orleans and African-American. Just the whole topic of HIV or even just the conversation about your sexuality was not something that was popular for the African-American community. And unfortunately, today, it's still a struggle. And as a result, we're seeing an increase in infections and other alarming statuses that are coming and being a part of the contributions as it relates to HIV.
Mm-hmm. And on April 12th of 1983, the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services reported that AIDS was a number one priority for HHS and that they had all the funding they needed. On that same day, Dr. Donald Francis, who was in charge of AIDS laboratory research at the CDC, wrote a memo to his superiors stating, and this is a quote, "The inadequate funding to date has seriously restricted our work and has presumably deepened the invasion of this disease into the American population. In this vast and wealthy country, there must be a way to get $10 to $20 million immediately for this disease. I stress speed because the usual government funding and spending processes are so slow as to be unacceptable in such an emergency situation," end quote. Are there important lessons that we can learn here from the initial U.S. response to the AIDS crisis? Because, I mean, looking in retrospect, I think a lot of people are more critical now than perhaps they were at the time.
Absolutely. I think that it's very important that the disease wasn't really taken seriously by the media, by the government, by researchers, anyone, until the threat of heterosexual transmission was raised, until it started entering the, quote, general population. Nobody seemed to really care or notice that people in the gay community were going to 2 and 3 funerals a week, every week, and people were dying all over the place. And no one seemed to notice. I think the clip that you played mentioned Legionnaire's disease. Mm. And that disease struck people who were white and who were heterosexual, and that disease got knocked out pretty quickly.
Right. Randy Schultz, pioneering gay journalist in 1987, he published a book I think we're probably all familiar with called And the Band Played On, adapted into a film as well. And I've heard interviews of him where he, you know, was very critical of the Reagan administration's response. AIDS was detected 5 months into Reagan taking office, and he'd campaigned on this platform of really keeping a tight lid on federal domestic spending. And that commitment really kind of kept that administration or the federal government at that time from allocating more financial resources towards research, towards understanding what was going on. So to kind of paraphrase Randy Schultz's words, he kind of says we looked at something as a political problem that was really a public health crisis.
I think mostly because it did hit the gay community, they really didn't think it was important. And I don't think they realized how it would spread through the entire general population. But I think it was more of a gay thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that was probably – and it was probably part of the reason they didn't fund it the way they should have funded it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and as we began to understand more about how it's transmitted, how it isn't transmitted, you know, and you had mentioned before, Billy, you know, heterosexual women starting to come down with it, hemophiliac patients from contaminated blood transfusions. Did that change attitudes perhaps in a positive way or a negative way, or do you think neutral? And by that, I'm just thinking, you know, taking it away from it being, you know, a gay men's disease by showing that anyone can get it, but at the same time creating more fear or hostility towards gay people.
Well, if they felt, and I think that they did think that the gay population started it and it spread to everybody else, then yes, they thought that
to me, it was like a lot of times it was like, well, this is behavior that brought this, you know, this sinful thing up on you. Right? It was always couched in a moralistic or religious term. So it was like gay people, or it was like drug users, or it was like prostitutes and so on and so forth. So because it hit that like more, I guess, the edge of a demographic instead of the the center. A lot of times people dismissed it until it became truly worldwide and an epidemic, and then people really started to fund it and get the resources for it.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to just real quickly kind of go back to the early years of the crisis. And I wonder if in some ways gay men themselves weren't serving as a barrier to public health officials and infectious disease specialists getting a handle on the epidemic. And I'm thinking of a public meeting in San Francisco where officials are considering closing down the bathhouses, and the room is filled with homosexual men from the Castro district going like, look, we've etched out this one little part of a community where we can be ourselves and not feel like freaks, and it's nobody else's business how, where, or who we have sex with. And they're framing it as a human rights issue. And the people at the other end of the table are going, hey, big picture, you're not going to care about your human rights if you're dead. And I mean, I think maybe even the gay community didn't fully understand what was going on, even as they were being primarily impacted. Billy, yeah.
I think this the disease in the early years and the especially the media coverage of it, the way that it was treated in the public did detrimental, very detrimental harm to the gay community and the relationship between gay, especially gay men, and sex. I think that the closing down of the bathhouses was the worst thing that could have happened. I think that is where a lot of information about safe sex happened. And to cut off those community spaces like that and to demonize sex in the way that it was and make people fearful of sex instead of educating people and coming up, innovating new ways to have sex, maybe that were safer, and things that couldn't happen when you close down those spaces. So I teach queer theory. I co-teach it with Dr. Braddy, and we talk about a lot of the ways that people have reacted to that negative attitude towards sex in ways that actually make it important again.
Mm-hmm. What about Ryan White? I mean, I think he was a very important figure, I think, in the 80s and during the AIDS crisis. I mean, he became like this national poster child. And then he was kicked out of his middle school because of his HIV status. Do you think that did something maybe to humanize it towards a population that was, fearful and hostile towards homosexual people by and large?
I think it did because he was a child.
Yeah.
He was a baby who was sick and being discriminated against because he was sick.
Yeah.
It wasn't his fault.
The blood transfusion.
Yeah.
Right.
He didn't ask for this like a lot of other people were. They were couching it like, oh, this is their behavior. But he wasn't. He just had a blood transfusion. So it kind of like showed, this is open to everyone. And I remember a lot of discussion when, especially you're talking about the Reagan administration when, he was from Hollywood and when, like, I think it was Rock Hudson was diagnosed of it. It kind of, shocked the Reagan administration, like, all right, what is happening here? What is going on? So strange funding started going from different places.
And at that time, they didn't even know that Rock Hudson was gay.
Right.
So it was
right.
Like, here he is gay, and now he has AIDS. What's going on here?
Mm-hmm. Right. On today's program, we're taking a look back at the AIDS era and its devastating toll, and whether young people today truly understand the impact. We're talking with Visuality Incorporated co-founder Arlene Goldberg, FGCU communication professors Billy Huff and John Braddy, as well as David Fairman-Jackson with the McGregor Clinic. Connect with our guests with your comments and questions by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Write to us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And David Fairman-Jackson, I wanted to turn attention to you here because I think Dr. Braddy and Dr. Huff see students, but you see folks sort of from a different angle. Tell us a bit about your work at the McGregor Clinic.
Yes, as the community prevention specialist at McGregor Clinic, I'm responsible for building relationships with the clients that walk through our doors. I'm providing educational services throughout the communities in what we call Area 8, also known as Southwest Florida. The great component of my job is that I'm able to sort of step out of the box with approaches to reach not only our youth, but our adult communities as well to educate them properly as it relates to their sexual health and specifically concerning their HIV concerns.
Do you find that there are folks, you know, maybe who aren't even of the millennial generation, maybe there are folks who did live through the 80s but still just have misinformation?
Absolutely. There is a lot of misinformation, primarily because of miseducation. Cultural stigma plays a great role. We have certain cultures where it's just not proper, it's not acceptable to have these conversations, not only about HIV, but about sex, period. And we're finding adults walking into the clinic totally confused as to even the four basic fluids that HIV can be contracted from. So it's a great obligation. And it's a great challenge for us as the staff of McGregor Clinic to correct that one person at a time.
Right, right. Do you work with a lot of younger people, you know, folks who presumably wouldn't remember any of the things we've been talking about today?
I am able to, and I have worked with youth in Southwest Florida, and it's surprising when we have conversations as it relates to what HIV means to them or what does it look like. You hear from the millennials and that there aren't conversations or there aren't safe spaces to have these conversations. The information they're receiving from older friends or family members is so tainted, it almost puts this fear in them to almost just withdraw and find a hole to crawl in. And as community education specialists, that's a part of the job where we are able to have corrective conversations and give them the proper information that they need.
I mean, do you see, you know, younger kids today who maybe have an attitude towards HIV as like, oh, well, I can take a pill and I'll be fine? Is it really that bad?
Yeah, with the invention of PrEP and everyone jumping on board with that, it is a great service. But for the millennial generation, it's almost giving them like a pass card to say, well, if I take this pill, you know, everything is awesome. But our focus is to help them understand your sexual health and protecting yourself first there. Yes, the product is here to help you as a supplemental or as an enhancement, but the priority is to protect your sexual health.
Well, and are they, do you think they're maybe just overlooking bigger picture issues, like the fact that you're going to be taking costly medication for the rest of your life, the long-term health impacts?
I believe for the millennial generation, they are overlooking the concept that this is a great commitment, first of all. It's a pill that they will take for 90 days consecutively, and it's important that they stick to the regimen. And conversations I've had with the youth, especially the males, I often say it's a bit simpler to use a condom for that one little 10 or 15-minute rendezvous you're going to have versus committing to taking this prescription for 90 days, one pill a day.
Right.
And when you weigh that option, a box of condoms typically run about $12 to $14. Or even you can go into a local clinic such as McGregor and get those for free versus trying to figure out how am I going to pay for this PrEP care program and am I going to remember to even take the medication.
Do you spend most of your time with clients in the clinic setting or you out in the community or both?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. Okay. We're out in the community and we're also in the clinic. I'm most excited when I'm out in the community because at that point we get to reach those individuals that will never walk into a medical facility. Right. There's a lot of stigma surrounded just even walking through the door or pulling into the parking lot. Some clients actually have challenges with that. So it's a great, great opportunity when we're out in the community reaching those individuals that we need to have a hands-on experience with and that traditionally will probably never walk through our door.
Right, right. And I know you have partnerships with, I guess, what are traditionally known as you know, gay-friendly establishments.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, you're literally going into like bars and restaurants.
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned the bars. Rascals of Southwest Florida, which is, I believe, on Cleveland Avenue. They have recently started, joined forces with us. We are hosting fundraisers there to help McGregor Clinic solidify a mobile unit, which will increase our opportunity and our visibility in the community to provide free rapid testing. And with that testing, we also provide education to help them understand why we're doing the testing, to help them understand the importance of practicing safe sex, and then ultimately giving them their result.
David, who should get tested and how often?
Everyone should get tested, be it heterosexual, transsexual, however you want to say it. If you're a human being and we all are sexual characters, it is important for individuals to be tested at least every 3 to 6 months. We do offer testing at McGregor Clinic, and we're there Monday through Friday between the hours of 8 a.m. and 4:30 p.m.
All right. And, you know, Do you ever talk to kids or even older folks about, I guess, the AIDS era, or are you just really kind of more focused on what's happening today and what sort of services we have today?
We've had opportunities to speak with youth, and we're seeing an increase in opportunities to speak to our elderly population. And having those conversations with the elders of Southwest Florida, it's very interesting when a young adult male walks in to have a conversation with someone that almost resembles my grandfather as it relates to their sexual health.
Right.
Yes. But it's a great chance, and we enjoy those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Hoff and Dr. Brady, you know, as you work with, you know, students who are of this age where they wouldn't have any, you know, working memory of the 80s, do you get a general sense of apathy, or do you think it's just truly just a lack of information?
I think it's just a lack of information, and they get so few opportunities to get that information. We've taught the queer theory class now 3 years in a row, and the class has 70 students, and we fill it every time. They're hungry for these kinds of conversations and information, but they just don't get it in very many places.
I do think it's important to understand the symbolic value of bodily fluid exchange. And a lot of the – not a lot, but a few of the students or millennials that I talk to are well-informed. They know how it's transmitted. They understand what safe sex practices are. They know when it's not safe. And they're making decisions to forego safe sex. So I do think there is a symbolic exchange, and it's always kind of been there. I don't think they see the, you know, the daily deaths like we did in the 80s and the 90s. They don't see it on television as much. So there is a removal from it. But I do think it's something that needs to be addressed.
All right. And, you know, when you do talk to these students, I like that you say that, you know, some of them are well informed, but for the popularity that the class has, how you say the kids are hungry for this knowledge, do they seem maybe almost like angry? Like, why did nobody tell me this until now?
Yes, we get that at the end of every semester. They do their final reflections, and we get a lot of that. Like, they feel like they've been brainwashed their whole lives, or that they.
It's true.
So absolutely.
And we're even, as an agency at McGregor Clinic, when it really comes to our education and outreach, we provide HIV education to some local businesses as a part of their ongoing process for staff, and it is quite shocking. When we have these sessions with adults exceeding ages 35 plus, at the end of this 4-hour class, they are totally educated properly about what HIV really is, and they have a whole new concept of it. And then you hear all of the tainted ideas of what they assumed it was and how the community had brought it to their attention. And they have this fresh new look. They want to share all of the information. And it's just a great, great opportunity when you can walk into a place, properly educate someone on the realities and the facts about HIV and AIDS, and set them on the right road.
All right. Well, that is we are about running out of time for the hour. It goes by fast. But thank you so much to my guests, Visuality co-founder Arlene Goldberg. So great to speak with you.
Thank you.
FGCU communication professors Dr. John Brady and Billy Huff. Great to have you in studio as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And also thanks to McGregor Clinic outreach and prevention specialist David Fairman Jackson. Always good to have you in studio.
Thank you so much.
The second installment of the Visuality Voices public panel discussion on the AIDS era takes place Wednesday, April 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. in the evening in Seidler Hall here at Florida Gulf Coast University. For more information about the event online, go to www.visualityflorida.org. There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my co-host Topher Forges and producers Richard Chinqui and AJ Leonard. This is WGCU FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.